I interviewed who either attended an all-boys school or had the chance to take key subjects in a single-sex class within a co-ed environment. Many confirmed the freedom they felt to shed their masks. 17-year-old Liam explained, "When I'm in a class with girls, sometimes I feel that for girls to like me, I have to be cool, and being smart isn't cool. The guys who everybody considers the most cool don't do that well academically. They never raise their hands in class. But in an all-boys class, I can really concentrate on academics," Liam continued. "I don't have to feel uncomfortable about how I am perceived by the girls in the class, and I don't have to worry that they think I'm a geek or a dork or something like that. Now I work hard, and I am definitely doing my best. I feel good when I get a good grade." When I talked with Toby, a bright-eyed 15-year-old dressed in a wrinkled shirt and jeans, who attends an all-boys school, he described a number of benefits to receiving an education in a single-sex institution. "Academically, I've been able to strive because there haven't been girls around to impress or anything. In class, I can raise my hand and say whatever I want to say, because I am not going to be embarrassed by talking around girls. You don't have to worry about the normal things, like how your clothes look or ironing. It's just a lot easier to work with no girls around. I can see girls on weekends, but I'm not distracted by their presence at school. At a boys' school, I can just go out there and take chances, I guess. I can be the best student that I could be." Toby also observed teachers bonding with male students more when girls are absent from the environment. "Teachers, especially women teachers, always like girls better. Here you get to be closer to your teachers, male and female, even if you're a boy." He contrasted his current experience with his earlier years in a co-ed school. "I think people expect girls to be smarter, so it's hard for a guy to excel academically just because of the situation they are in. When I was in a co-ed school, a lot of little things would embarrass me, like answering a question wrong in class, or making a mistake on the athletic field, or having one of my friends make a wisecrack about me in front of other kids." Teachers and administrators corroborate what these boys are saying. For instance, two formerly single-sex schools that merged into coeducation years ago, St. Stephen's, St. Agnes School in Alexandria, Virginia, have experimented with keeping some math and science classes segregated by gender. The results have been positive. "All of the advantages we see benefit both boys and girls," one administrator commented. "Teachers can tailor the way they teach their classes, the amount of group work, and the amount of individual learning." The experiment that these two schools implemented is a good example of the kind of creative problem-solving I believe is critical when it comes to developing successful schools for boys. Even when its resources are tight, a school, public or private, can implement innovative programs and approaches to help boys thrive emotionally and academically. What I find sad is schools not taking this extra step when they simply rest on their laurels. For I believe it's just this kind of complacency that has led so many boys to rebel in the classroom and that has triggered our school's epidemic overdiagnosis of behavioral disorders in young and adolescent boys. Prescription: How parents can help create schools for boys' voices. To alleviate the negative impact of gender stereotyping and anti-boy bias, I urge parents to take several steps. Praise your boy's school achievements. Just as it's vitally important to affirm girls' unique talents and strengths, I believe boys, as tough, invulnerable, and confident as they may seem on the outside, desperately need to hear our words of praise and encouragement about what they're doing well at in school. We need to reinforce all their successes at school, not just those typically thought of as masculine. A kindergarten boy who successfully mixes together the ingredients for cookies in the kitchen play area yearns for and deserves a compliment just as much as the one who builds a 4-foot tower with building blocks. The boy who writes the best essay on Chaucer merits praise as much as the one who aced his geometry exam. You simply can't give your boy too much positive reinforcement. When parents or teachers see a boy's mask go up, when our sons begin to act tough and self-reliant, there's a tendency to want to respond in the same way. We often feel we're going to humiliate the boy in some way if we don't reflect back the same kind of cool, dispassionate attitude. While it's important not to pressure your boy to discuss things if he's not yet up to it, you should not feel you need to match his macho stoicism with your own. Instead, try to contradict his masked insecurities by giving him lots of love, support, and affirmation. When he comes home from school and grunts when you ask him how his test went, tell him that no matter what grade he got, you believe in him. Look for opportunities to be specific in your words of approbation. For instance, if you read a story he wrote and you notice he's got an impressive authorial flair, tell him how much fun it was to read his story. If he completes a scientific experiment for his biology class and prepares a report with handsome graphics in it, tell him what a great job he did in putting together the report, and that you especially noticed the neat graphics. Even if he shrugs off your positive comments, continue to share them with him. It's this kind of consistent warm praise that goes a long way in helping your boy endure the many less positive messages he's bound to receive at school. Get involved, stay involved. Observe and monitor the progress of boys in your particular school system. How are boys faring? Do the teachers and administrators have a modern understanding of boys' dilemmas in our society, and understand how those dilemmas affect boys within a learning environment? Call meetings, sponsor workshops, attend after-school programs, and make sure that the school is evaluating itself regularly and is being creative about developing approaches for boys that work. Demand that schools recognize your boy's unique learning style and pace. If he needs extra help in English, make sure he's getting it. If he learns writing best by using an interactive computer program rather than copying paragraphs from a textbook, lobby for him to get sufficient time with the computer. If he has a hard time sticking with any one activity for more than a certain length of time, make sure he's given all sorts of projects to work on. Observe and monitor his emotional life. Third, in addition to monitoring how well he's doing based on report cards and other similar evaluations, try to keep an eye on how you think your son is faring emotionally at school. Try your best to create safe spaces for him at home, and advocate that his school do the same. Ideally, no boy should have to spend an entire school day without having anywhere he can go to express his vulnerable emotions, free from attack or ridicule. As often as possible, when your boy comes home after school, ask him what he likes about school and what he doesn't like so much about it. Inquire who his best friends are. Ask him what teachers he prefers. If he doesn't open up right away, tell him about your own school experiences. Talk about the exam you forgot to study for. Tell him about how some of the other kids drove you crazy. Tell the story about that fifth-grade teacher you couldn't stand. By showing your own vulnerability, your boy may grow comfortable showing his own. And by finding out what he's truly feeling about school, you can do your best not only to confirm that he's being treated properly, but also to discern whether he feels positively about how well he's doing as a student. If we are to redress the crisis of low self-esteem among so many of our sons, we first need to give them a place to tell us how they're feeling and what they're experiencing. Don't let schools misjudge your boy. Fourth, if there are deficiencies in your boy's academic performance or any shortcomings in his conduct, make sure they are not rashly treated by his school as though he's pathological. If he suffers a severe learning disability or legitimately has attention deficit disorder, obviously he should meet with a knowledgeable educational specialist, psychologist, or psychiatrist to explore appropriate options. But before any rushed judgments are made, it's important to spend as much time as possible with your son to give him the chance to open up and tell you what school is actually like for him. In so many cases, when your son reluctantly reveals his poor test result, or low grade, or confesses to having gotten in trouble at school with a student or teacher, the problem does not stem from the boy's pathology. As discussed above, it may well be the school that is deficient, often because it hasn't created an atmosphere in which the boy can succeed. Sometimes, a school is too rigid with a boy who needs a more open exploratory classroom experience. Sometimes, a school doesn't address his particular pace and style of learning, going too fast or too slow, requiring too much passive listening or too many rote exercises. And sometimes, because of gender stereotypes and biases, a school either restricts him from participating in activities he genuinely finds interesting, or prematurely writes him off as a troublemaker. If your boy begins to behave inappropriately at school, I strongly suggest speaking not only to his teachers, but also to other parents with kids in the same school. You may very well discover that it's not just your boy who is struggling at his school or with a particular teacher there. When behavioral issues arise for your son, it's terribly important to explore all the possible factors contributing to the situation before allowing the school to dictate a quick-fix solution that may actually serve the school better than your boy. Help shape the mission of the school. Try to ensure that your boy's school is thoughtful about the unique needs of all boys. For example, it's important for parents and teachers to interrupt situations where they see boys being put into gender straitjackets as students. If a teacher overhears one boy telling another that poetry is for wimps, ideally, that teacher will intervene and explain that not only is reading and writing poetry appropriate for boys, but a good number of our most favorite poets are actually men. If a parent learns that the elective courses in a junior high school, such as tech, art, chorus, drama, are designed to be gender segregated, I hope that parent will find the courage to approach the school administrators and insist that boys and girls be made to feel equally welcome to try out these courses. I think it's particularly helpful when parents, teachers, and school administrators meet regularly at PTA meetings, special workshops, and so on, to study how boys are being educated to ensure that the school's curriculum is structured in a manner empathic to boys. Boys must not become a political football, the target of a backlash against the ways we fail to meet girls' rightful entitlements. Rather, Boys' specific educational needs should be reviewed as closely and carefully as the needs of girls. I also believe it's important for us to figure out when traditional schools simply are inappropriate or ineffectual for a particular boy. Less conventional academic teaching methods, such as Outward Bound or other group team activities that build on boys' physicality in a more open setting, may help both to expand our view of intelligence to a larger range of skills, as Howard Gardner has so aptly argued, and to capture more of boys' interests as well. The use of media, such as videos or CD-ROMs, with fast-paced activity, may capture the interest of many a boy stuck in more traditional literary text. Integrating sports activities and coaches, arts programs and specialists may be just the ticket to spark the sagging interest of an educationally turned-off boy, or to discover the hidden talent of one of our sons buried beneath the sense of shame and failure emanating from his frustration within an all-too-traditional, all-too-rigid curriculum. Whatever the creative intervention aimed at boys, and there are many more than space allows me to mention, when we don't probe what it really takes to meet boys' needs, they, in turn, lose interest, don't perform well, and begin the downhill slide into feeling bad about themselves. What schools and school systems can do. Whether or not parents prod them to do so, schools need to develop and implement innovative approaches to address boys' specific needs as students. Boy-friendly subject matter. Just as any adult who goes into a bookstore tends to select books that mesh with his or her personal interests, it is critical that our schools teach courses that cover subject matter interesting to a wide range of boys. We all know that there is not just one kind of boy, and thus there cannot be a simple answer to what topics and what materials will stimulate every boy. But a school can be creative in developing eclectic classroom materials and covering a broad range of topics that will spark the interest of many boys and many girls. For example, in English, this means covering poems, stories, novellas, novels, and other literature by male and female authors and on traditionally male and female topics. In a subject like history, making the class stimulating for boys might mean reading and telling stories not only about men, but also from the perspective of men. It's so easy for schools to make classes interesting to our boys in this way. I believe it is truly unacceptable for them not to take this simple step. Use teaching methods that work well for boys. As we've seen in this chapter, many boys may have different learning styles than girls do. Schools need to make sure that they're aware of this and doing something about it. For young boys, this may mean providing lots of opportunities for hands-on learning and problem-solving and a lot of interactive teaching. So, for instance, rather than asking 8-year-olds to do math problems from a book, a teacher might instead set up a game show where the boys solve math problems as contestants on the show. Rather than reading a fable to little boys, a teacher might convey the same literature through a puppet show in which the boys have the chance to talk to and interact with the puppets during and after the show. In a class teaching poetry, instead of asking each child to read several classic poems and then write his or her own poem, the teacher might have a guest speaker come in to read his or her own poems and then ask that guest speaker to coach the students through writing a group poem on a boy-friendly topic that would come to life on the classroom blackboard. Older boys, too, need lots of creative opportunities as students. In an English class on Shakespeare, rather than simply assigning Romeo and Juliet, Teachers may have much greater success asking students to act out the parts in class. In a class on economics, rather than asking students to sit quietly and write out answers to questions in a textbook, the teacher might instead assign the students to groups, give them a short period to discuss their answers, and then hold a classroom debate in which a designated representative from each group participates in the deliberations. For a boy who becomes restless when he's asked to sit in his chair and read history, a teacher might give him the chance to use a multimedia CD-ROM to learn the same required information. Even with very limited resources, a school can be creative about using teaching methods that keep boys interested and involved. Respect the learning pace of every boy. There is probably nothing so humiliating as being asked to learn material before one is ready or able. As we've seen, boys often lag behind girls at school, particularly in the areas of reading and writing. I believe it is absolutely critical for schools to be sensitive to each boy's individual pace as a learner. For example, there's little use asking a boy to start writing short stories if he cannot yet complete a sentence. Likewise, there's no use asking an older boy to begin reading Homer if he cannot make his way through the simplest of texts. As a practical matter, this means that schools not only need to regularly determine where each boy is testing in every important subject area, but also to structure classes, give assignments, and test students using materials that are appropriate to their then-current level of understanding. Put simply, if some boys need more time to learn, schools need to be patient and give them that time. Otherwise, as we've discovered, they simply don't learn very well, and their self-esteem as students falls dramatically. Experiment with same-sex classes. As illustrated earlier in this chapter, some schools have discovered that, especially for boys who are slower learners or who do not do well within traditional coeducational classrooms, it may be helpful to place them in all boys' classes, at least in the subject areas where they are doing poorly. By setting up boys-only classes, schools enable teachers to focus in a positive way on the needs of the students and develop classroom materials, teaching methods, and a pace of teaching that correspond to those specific needs. Also, by removing boys from classes attended by their female counterparts, much of the pressure boys often feel to act in certain self-protective ways becomes significantly diminished, and many boys come to feel freer, more confident, and better able to succeed as students. I believe this to be true despite the report recently made by the American Association of University Women entitled Segregated by Sex, A Critical Look at Single-Sex Education for Girls, which denied finding much improvement for girls placed in single-sex environments, after the same association in 1992 had advocated separating girls to enhance their classroom experiences. Many educators persistently cite success with same-gender programs for both girls and boys. So I strongly suggest that schools, both public and private, continue to experiment with setting up properly supervised all-boys programs. Hire more male teachers. It's critical that school systems make serious efforts to find more male teachers, especially at elementary schools, where boys are first forming notions about gender-appropriate behavior. Although I have shown how important mothers and other women may be in helping boys to achieve healthy masculinity, if all or almost all of their role models at elementary school are women, how can we expect these little boys to see learning and the celebration of learning as things that men do? Imagine how many parents would be up in arms if all their girls' high school teachers were men. Why, then, I wonder, do we tolerate elementary schools for our boys, taught predominantly or exclusively by women? Likewise, throughout school systems, I believe it's important that men and women be hired to teach in less gender-stereotypic areas, so that, for instance, not all of the science and math classes are taught by men, and all of the literature and arts classes are taught by women. This will go a long way in helping boys feel more comfortable and confident about succeeding in areas, whether it's learning how to write haiku or figuring out how to sew a hem, where normally they would fear ridicule or failure. Set up mentoring programs. Boys benefit enormously from having mentors who are sympathetic to them as learners and who can serve as models for what it's possible to achieve. Because of all the ways in which our schools continue to be weak in recognizing boys' unique emotional and scholastic needs, I believe that mentoring programs are of special importance to boys. I've spoken just above about the significance of having more male teachers in our schools, but let me emphasize that a boy's mentor can, of course, be male or female. An adult, such as a teacher, guidance counselor, or school administrator, or even an older student. What's most important is that the mentor be interested in the boy's growth and development, and ideally that he or she have personal interests that are relatively compatible with those of the boy, so that, for instance, a boy who loves football is not paired with a teacher who abhors all sports. The mentor, in my opinion, can do several things for the boy. First, he or she can simply check in with the boy on a regular basis, at least once per week, to see how things are going for him emotionally and academically. To help the mentor, the school might prepare a list of questions the mentor should consistently ask, such as, "How is your English class going? What homework are you getting? Can you show me how you did on it? What's going on with the other students in the class? Are they good people? Who do you spend time with? What's the teacher like? Do you enjoy being in the class with that teacher?" In effect, the questions should be designed to elicit not only how the boy is doing scholastically, but also how things are going for him emotionally. Second, the mentor should offer to help him, to the extent possible, in those classes and subject matters where the boy is doing less well. Helping him may mean tackling areas where the boy actually needs to be coached, but it may also mean finding out who his teacher is, contacting that teacher, and making sure that he or she is aware of the boy's needs and working with him or her to address them creatively. Finally, the mentor should simply become a devoted buddy to the boy. By knowing he's got an older friend who cares about his social and academic progress, the boy will feel greater confidence in all his interactions and activities at school. Especially for boys who at home may not be getting the kind of intimate, caring attention they ideally should be, for instance, boys with two parents who work long hours, or with a single overworked parent. Having a mentor who is empathic to them and watching out for their ongoing emotional and academic needs is of immense value and can make a hugely positive impact on these boys' achievements at school. Provide safe guy spaces. Finally, just as schools have attempted to create a comfortable environment in which girls can have their own voice as learners and feel free to express their thoughts and opinions in an open, genuine way, schools must take appropriate steps to ensure that boys can do the same and feel they have a safe haven at school where they can express vulnerable emotions. Creating such safe guy spaces helps undo some of the shame-based hardening, loosening the straitjackets of gender, and allowing boys to connect again, not only with the excitement of their minds, but with the genuine depth of their hearts and souls. This involves several steps. First, for boys of all ages, schools need to set up the school schedule with times and places at school where boys feel free to be themselves, free of normal classroom constrictions. For younger boys, for instance, this may mean making sure that there are enough breaks each day, during which boys can enjoy uninhibited play and engage in the gross motor activities that may come naturally to them. Some schools have successfully experimented with shifting the time in which boys go to gym class so that it's not always at the end of the day. For older boys, providing guy spaces may mean setting up indoor and outdoor study halls, ideally supervised by adult mentors of the kind I described above, where boys can talk, romp, dish, and rumble to their heart's desire. Some schools have found that setting up the indoor space as a quiet space and the outdoor space as a freer space allows boys, depending on their individual propensities, to choose the kind of space that most suits them. These study halls can happen once or several times a day, depending on the resources of the school and how effective the particular school finds them. What is most important is giving boys the chance to enjoy the kinds of less restricted, action-oriented behavior that, as we've seen throughout this book, helps many of them to flourish emotionally and intellectually. In addition, I believe schools should make absolutely sure that boys always feel they have a place to go at school, where they can and where they will discuss their inner emotional lives with girls and other boys and with teachers and other adults. These safe spaces can be single-gender or co-ed, supervised closely by an adult, or set up as kids-only centers along the lines of the peer support groups we discussed in the chapter on adolescence. It simply is not enough for schools to assume that boys will get their emotional needs taken care of at home. In my opinion, it's not fair to boys or their parents for two basic reasons. First, many parents are already doing the best they can, given their other obligations, and simply cannot do it all without the help of their son's schools. Second, some parents are not available to their boys for any emotional support. They may be either physically or emotionally absent, or both. So schools have an obligation, I think, to pick up the emotional ball and run with it. It doesn't take a lot of extra funding or personnel to set up effective peer support groups, social centers, discussion groups, and so on. I believe that every school should ask itself, if a student in our school is unhappy about something in his or her life, school-related or otherwise, would that student have a place he or she would want to go to talk about that unhappiness? If the answer to that question is no, the school probably has not yet met its responsibilities. So, as our boys traverse the blackboard jumble, I firmly believe that schools need to address their ongoing emotional needs in an honest, consistent, dedicated way. Only then will a boy and his parents be able to trust that the many hours of time he will end up spending at school will most likely be enriching and enjoyable, hours well spent that will lead him to grow up into a happy, intellectually curious, emotionally fulfilled, and successful young man. Chapter 11. Sports, Play and Transformation. There's this real warm feeling you get. I don't know how to explain it. Like we're all in something together, and it's even okay to lose. Martin, age 13. The Paradox of Sports, The Doing and Undoing of the Boy Code. One of the oldest forms of recreation known to humankind, sports are the one arena in which many of society's traditional strictures about masculinity are often loosened, allowing boys to experience parts of themselves they rarely experience elsewhere. At their best, sports provide boys with an opportunity for play in a free atmosphere, so that they can be themselves and express a full range of emotions, from the exhilaration of a last-minute goal to the acute disappointment of being defeated by the opposing team. From the joy of being the one to pull off an unexpected play to the embarrassment of fumbling the ball in the last quarter of the game. Sports provide boys with a theater for the unfettered expression of their feelings, a place where it's okay to be spirited, emotive, passionate. As 12-year-old Max told me, "During school we have to be quiet and raise our hands to talk. It's boring, and sometimes I feel like there's nobody to talk to. I love doing sports after school because we can all be together. We get to run fast, shout things out, scream, whatever. It lets me be me." For many boys, sports are a form of intimacy and a way to be honest. By temporarily freeing boys from the boy code, especially from the rules that say boys shouldn't express feelings, show affection, or expose their yearning for connection, sports can become one of the most important activities through which our sons, as their genuine selves, can relate closely with girls and other boys. But just as much as they can offer a break from the boy code, a chance for openness, expression, and intimacy, sports can also push boys back to loneliness, shame, and vicious competition. "It's rough out there," one high school football player recently told me. "Some guys play hard, just the way they should. But other guys just seem like they're out to get you. You know, they just try to demolish you." Thus, sports can also be a place where boys show unbridled aggression, let out inappropriate feelings of anger and frustration, and actually hurt other boys. And then sports can thrust boys into a cult of competition, the goal of winning at any cost, a quest for narcissistic glory at the expense of others. They cause some boys, especially those who are not interested in sports, or who are not skilled at playing them, to feel left out, unworthy, ashamed. I firmly believe that the positive benefits to boys dim when sports cease to be play. D.W. Winnicott, the distinguished English psychoanalyst, observed that for children, play is at the heart of healthy, integrated development. His words are especially pertinent to boys whose inner selves are too often suppressed. Playing shows that the child is capable of developing a personal way of life, eventually becoming a whole being, welcomed by the world at large. Sheer competition among boys rarely builds character and does little to bring boys closer to one another. But sports, when they are play, can be a tremendously good thing for boys. The late Commissioner of Baseball and Renaissance scholar A. Bartlett Giamatti spoke of sports as that aspiration to be taken out of the self for a moment in touch with a joy free of all constraint. It is a sensation not of winning, but of fully playing. When sports are kept in proper perspective, when we see sports primarily as a chance for boys to come together for joyful, spirited, high-energy play, they can help boys discover new competencies, buttress their feelings of self-worth, and reunite them with their authentic voices, enabling them to express the deepest stirrings of emotion in their hearts widening their circle of connections. Sports as transformation. Indeed, I believe that with the right attitude and the right coach, sports are transformational for boys. When the boy code is relaxed and the mask can come off, our sons can go from being reserved, detached, and hardened to being expressive, affectionate, resilient. Sports transform boys in this way. Sports open them up, give them a new elan, a new authenticity, and they simply make many boys into far happier, far more fulfilled human beings. Listen, for instance, to Tom and Philip Marson, brothers aged 13 and 15, who tell us how sports can turn things around for boys. "There used to be nothing to do around here," Tom told me, referring to the small, economically depressed town where he and his brother live. "There was like just one bowling alley, and it was closed on weekends. We had nothing to do, especially during the summer," Philip agreed. "Not quite a year ago," Tom explained, "three of our best friends died of an OD. Indeed, the autumn before, three teenage boys in the same sleepy town had all drunk themselves into oblivion and then overdosed on a lethal cocktail of various barbiturates. Sure, the town had always had its problems, high unemployment, poorly funded schools, and many broken families, but this was different. Three boys, the oldest only 16, were gone forever. The mood in town was sullen the summer following the deaths, and Tom and Philip were resolved to change things. We went to the mayor and to the priest at our church, and we asked if we could set up a regular sports program for kids around here," Philip explained. "A softball league," Tom added. "What a great idea," I told the boys. "Yeah, at first we were just 10 guys," said Tom. "But then, like, everybody wanted to sign up, girls too," explained Philip. "Now there are too many kids who want to play, more than 100. But the state government offered to help with some money and coaches." "So it is making a difference to have this new league?" I asked the boys. "Hell yeah," Philip replied. "Now we've got a schedule. We've got something to do. I'm not sure I'd be here anymore if it wasn't for the league," added Tom. "For a long time I couldn't deal with things. Now I've got a place to go." Tom and Philip show us there are many ways in which sports can change things for boys, and I have found that there are at least four major areas in which sports are often transformational for boys. They free boys up to express a broad array of emotions. They allow boys to show their love and affection in a shame-free environment. They boost self-esteem. And they teach boys how to be flexible in difficult situations, how to deal with losing and loss in general. Because each of these areas has been so underexplored in the literature available to parents, I would like to discuss each of them in turn. Sports and transformation, emotional expression. The first area of transformation is that of emotional expression. Sports can be a forum where boys learn how to deal openly with feelings of failure, shame, sadness, and the simple realities of human limitations. Whether it's football, basketball, baseball, or golf, almost all sports provoke tremendous swings of emotion, highs and lows. Sometimes our victories and defeats are personal, for instance, when we win a game of one-on-one tennis, fall down when we're skiing, or score substantially below par in a round of golf. And sometimes they are communal. A basketball team's defense gets clumsy in the third quarter. A baseball team rallies to hit a string of home runs in the final inning of a home game. But whether we experience them individually or as a team, these ups and downs encompass a plethora of emotions. Joy, despair, pride, embarrassment, anger, triumph, humility. Sports help boys handle these feelings, much in the way that fathers, as we saw in Chapter 6, teach young boys how to handle intense emotions through rough-and-tumble play. Indeed, on the court and in the field, boys, if they are not discouraged from doing so, often seem impressively capable of sharing these kinds of feelings, free of the masks they usually feel pressured to wear. "Normally I would never cry in front of my friends," explains Josh, the 17-year-old quarterback of his high school football team. "But when we lose a game, especially if it's really close, I've seen a lot of guys cry. Sometimes you just can't hold it back." "We almost made it to the state finals," said 15-year-old Peter, lamenting his track team's recent lost match to another local team. "At our last meet, when we lost in pole vaulting, and then in the 500-meter run, our captain was so fed up, he just got all choked up and started to cry." "Football's a pretty rough sport," 17-year-old Willis explained. "And a few weeks ago, one of our guys got really badly injured, and they had to take him away in an ambulance. There was this really long timeout, so our whole team got together, went into a huddle, and started praying for him. Some of the guys were really shaken up by it." For many boys, sports is the one place where they sense it's all right to show what they really feel and who they really are. Because the source of their feelings is external and obvious, a missed goal, a great shot, a huge win, a narrow loss, the shame they usually experience if they show these feelings can sometimes fall away. Especially with a coach who does not humiliate them for their mistakes, and who instead encourages them despite how they perform, boys can come to feel less inhibited, freed to share their feelings honestly, without fear of embarrassment. Sports help boys break out from behind the silence of the mask, and allow them to assert sides of themselves they ordinarily feel pressured to hide. Sports and transformation. Friendship and affection. Teaching connections. Through sports, boys can also transform themselves by ending their isolation and discovering comfortable ways to share the caring and affection they feel for their peers. And in this sharing, sports may lead boys toward friendships with girls and other boys, friendships with their own physical vocabulary and their own disciplines of love. Lionel, the 16-year-old captain of his highly touted high school basketball team, spoke to me about the kind of sharing he appreciates from his teammates. "When we win, we just get all together in a group huddle and start hugging each other, patting each other on the back. When we won against this undefeated team the other day, one guy in my team came up behind me and just grabbed me. For a second, I thought he was going to tackle me. But actually, he was just giving me this huge hug. He couldn't believe we won." For some boys, sports offer opportunities for emotional closeness too often lacking in other areas of their lives. Sports allow boys to feel a dedication to others, to experience feelings of love and commonality within comfortable bounds. In fact, boys often feel more comfortable caring about and nurturing one another in the context of playing sports than in almost any other area of life, so long as the caring and nurturing is expressed in the team concept and channeled toward a task, toward the external goals of the game. Because they feel that they are part of a higher mission beyond the self, Boys feel a kinship and a freedom to show affection that they don't tend to feel comfortable about in other contexts. Boys show these feelings sometimes by using words. Nice going. Don't worry about it. Hey, are you all right? And perhaps most often through physical gestures, such as a pat on the back, an embrace, a congratulatory slap on the buttocks, or thumbs up. For many boys, their most affectionate, intimate experiences take place when they are part of a group with a clear, common objective, to which deep feelings can legitimately be linked. In Mark Harris's baseball novel, Bang the Drum Slowly, one ball player expresses his feelings this way. You felt warm toward them, and you looked at them, and them at you, and you were both alive, and you might as well have said, ain't it something, being alive, I mean, ain't it really a great thing at that? And if they would have been a girl, you would have kissed them, though you never said such a thing out loud, but only went on about your business. Sports and transformation. A boost in self-esteem. A sense of mastery. When coaches and parents work hard to make sure that participating in sports does not become an emotionally damaging experience, the activity can also transform boys by offering them a chance to excel at something that comes naturally to many of them, to achieve a newfound sense of mastery, and thus to boost their self-esteem. Especially for boys who find it difficult to do well academically, sports may be one of the few contexts in which they receive praise. In team sports, boys may be able to feel a sense of success by making small contributions to the team's victories. A good pass, a nice save, a skillful tackle. Even when they're on the bench, playing a very minor role in a particular game, boys can often derive a sense of vicarious pride and accomplishment through the athletic prowess and success of teammates. Sean, self-esteem through hockey. I felt like there was nothing I could do the best, Sean said. His older brother, Nick, was an outstanding artist who had won statewide competitions with his drawings. His oldest sister, Maura, had frequently impressed her parents and grandparents at her dance recitals. And Christina, the sister closest to Sean in age, was a top flutist in her junior high school band. Meanwhile, Sean was just struggling in school, and by the age of 13 was beginning to be angry and defiant at home, too. While Sean's parents had always been convinced he was a bright child, Sean's performance at school was consistently mediocre. One of Sean's sixth-grade teachers was particularly perceptive. She told us Sean simply wasn't trying that hard, his mother, Lynn O'Hanley, remembered. He would be the first in the class to put down his pencil, even though he seemed capable of very good work. He was rushing through assignments. He always did his homework, but we could see that his homework was just anything to get it over with. We really thought about having Sean tested for ADD, although when he was home playing with Lego blocks or something he liked, he could sit for hours. Sean's father, John O'Hanley, had fond memories of playing ice hockey as a boy, and suggested he introduce Sean to a sport to build his self-confidence. Mr. O'Hanley brought Sean to a series of sporting events, basketball, football, baseball, soccer, and his own childhood favorite, ice hockey, then gave Sean the opportunity to pick one to pursue. I could see that Sean was enjoying just getting out alone with me. There aren't as many chances for that in a large family, says John. And I could have talked his ear off. I love talking sports. But I bit my tongue and just told a few stories about when I was a kid. I had decided not to give him any advice, but I admit I was pleased when Sean chose ice hockey. John attended every hockey practice with Sean, cheering him on from the sidelines. I made another pact with myself that I would never criticize Sean's mistakes, only praise his efforts, John explains. There's all this organized coaching now, even down to the baby levels, and it's easy for parents to become little assistant coaches. But we didn't have that. My parents came to the game and cheered. That's all they ever said about hockey. I knew I couldn't go to school with them every day, but this was something we could share together. Sean soon became one of the strongest players on his team. On the car rides back home, Sean would go over his best plays with me. I'd get tears in my eyes just to see him look so pleased with himself, John says. By that spring, Sean's grades had begun improving. I'm the greatest hockey player in my family, Sean now declares. Even better than my dad used to be when he was my age. Ice hockey gave Sean a chance to try with all his might at something he loved, John observes. I had my doubts, getting him up to practice at weird hours so he could get some ice time, and making those long drives to games in other towns. But it gave the two of us an opportunity to get closer as well, and you can't put a price on that. As Sean's story shows, if properly mentored, boys may find that sports provide them with a chance to apply skills that come easily to them, receive praise and attention they don't get elsewhere, and thus significantly increase their feelings of self-worth. Sports and transformation, lessons in resilience, facing loss. Finally, sports also transform boys by teaching them emotional resilience, how to overcome the fear of being shamed, a fear that can cause boys to toughen themselves up, especially when they become adolescents. Sports teach this capacity for resilience, a healthy ability to cope with shameful feelings openly and flexibly, through the inevitable experience of losing. Sports bring boys face to face with loss and allow them to express disappointment and grief they probably would not otherwise experience. To learn how to deal with defeat is also to come to terms with shame. One learns, as the poet A.E. Housman put it, that glory withers quicker than the rose. Unfortunately, parents and mentors may too often fail to teach sons about bearing such loss so that it then becomes something feared and is seen as catastrophic. If sports were only about glorious victory and humiliating one's opponents or one's less capable teammates, they would not help a boy to confront his fears and vulnerabilities. They would not transform him. But sports, in fact, do involve loss, and sports do transform boys because of this. "It's not so bad," 16-year-old Martin told me when I asked him how he feels when his soccer team loses a game. "We get depressed sometimes, and if we play an away game and lose, everybody is really quiet on the bus ride home. But there's this real warm feeling you get. I don't know how to explain it. Like we're all in something together, and it's even okay to lose." "There's nothing like winning," explained Hamilton, Martin's 17-year-old teammate. "Losing sucks, and you feel like you're a complete dork. But on the team, nobody ever blames you because they know they could screw things up the next time. Losing is just part of the game. It's part of being on the team, so you learn how to deal with it." "It makes you humble," adds 17-year-old Benson. And 16-year-old Arthur opines, "It's better than failing a test at school or something." "Why is that?" I asked. Well, on a test, you're all alone, and if you do bad, you're probably not going to tell anyone. You're just going to sulk and try not to show it. But when you lose a match, it's like, okay, everybody knows. And it's all of us losing together. There's no hiding it, and you just deal with it with all the other guys. As these boys' comments reflect, sports provide a community of support that somehow makes the disappointment of losing seem more bearable. In fact, I have found that if boys are coached properly, they may also discover, as did one high school football team I know, that this community includes not only their teammates and fans, but their opponents as well. The Hawks, Learning from Losing. The Hawks are a talented group of high school football players from a middle-class suburb of a large northeastern city. Not only do these boys know how to play football, but many of them excel academically, too. 6 feet tall, built like a linebacker, coach Paul Santanello boasts cheerfully about his team. "If you make it through a season with me and the team, I'd say you've also got a good 99.9999% chance you're headed for college." "That's wonderful," I tell Paul, who seems to me he not only knows how to prepare his team athletically, but also has a real knack for understanding the psychology behind sports. "I know how to get them psyched up for a game," he explains to me, "and I know what to tell them about winning and losing." "What do you mean?" I ask. "Well, for example, about a month ago, we had to play against one of the city teams. So before the other team arrived, I told the kids on my team a few key things. Number one, that the other team came from a school with different resources than our school has. So no laughing or teasing them about their tattered uniforms, their broken helmets, or whatever. Number two, that this was one of the top teams in the state, so be prepared and do the best you can. And number three, if you lose, don't say anything bad to the other side. Just shake hands with them and tell them that they played great." "Sounds like superb advice," I tell Paul. "Well, I don't know about that. But when the game came around, the boys really handled themselves pretty well. They gave 100%, did their best, although they got completely whomped by the other team. But nobody on my team said anything wrong to the other guys. There was complete respect, and when the game was over, my guys went over and congratulated the other team. That's really something." "My guys were so blown away by the other team," Paul adds with a smile, "that they asked me if they could do some Saturday scrimmages against them. We've been doing these Saturday morning things now for 6 weeks, and the kids seem to like them." "Sounds like a good opportunity for the boys." "Yeah, and not only that," Paul says proudly, "I now hear that guys on my team are starting to help some of the guys on the other team actually write their college admissions essays. You know, they've actually become friends and are helping each other out. So I'd say the kids on my team have learned a lot since losing that first game." As the story of the Hawks reflects, good sports are about learning from loss, especially about the recognition of limits. Unlike what happens in much of the rest of life, in sports the limits are obvious and the consequences for ignoring them are tangible and immediate. As Philip Eisenberg, Harvard Medical School psychiatrist and former Harvard football team captain, has pointed out, "Sports teach people that they have to live within the limits of the game and of their bodies, to realize their relative talents. No matter what one's skill level, there's almost always someone stronger, faster, or better coordinated. No matter how hard one tries to win, there's also the role of chance, the injured star player, the distracting fan, the wind that carries the ball. and no matter how unfair, losing is simply reality. And so this is the fourth important way in which sports transform boys. Sports take boys who thought they would always have to cover up their feelings of loss and vulnerability, and show these boys that losing and the pain that goes with it are part of life, that one can be honest about one's disappointments, and that all one can do is just get up again, head back into the field, and continue to do one's best. The emotional importance of the coach, a role model for one's personal best. My research shows that so much of what distinguishes what is good and transformative about sports from what is bad and destructive is what attitudes prevail among the people a boy plays with and how he is treated when he succeeds or fails in playing. And crucial to each of these factors is the coach. The coach and the emotional environment he or she creates within the team are essential to developing boys' sense of self-esteem and of connection to others. It is the role of the coach to encourage boys to play cooperatively while nudging them away from attitudes that may make them self-serving, overly aggressive, or even reckless. The coach may be an employee at the local school, a parent volunteering for an after-school program, or an older sibling leading younger kids in athletic play. When I refer to the coach, I mean anybody who supervises boys playing sports. So much of a boy's experience with sports, I believe, depends on the coach. How aware and sensitive he or she is, whether he or she mentors the boy, how the coach deals with a boy's strengths and weaknesses, his successes and failures. A coach is an emotionally important figure in a boy's life. When he or she cheers on boys at all skill levels, models a sense of fairness, and exudes a sense of levity, fun, and fair play that transcends winning or losing, a coach can make playing sports the immensely positive, transformative learning experience I've been speaking of. With the right coach, a boy is transformed from an isolated competitor into a bonded teammate, from someone who simply wants to beat the other guy to someone purely striving to do his personal best. A coach who ensures that sports are an inclusive activity, one who cheerfully embraces boys at all different skill levels, and who makes sure the other boys do too, can help each boy feel that he is able, skilled, and important, that he really matters to the team. This kind of coaching helps a boy not only to overcome his sense of loneliness and isolation, substituting connection for more removed autonomy, but also to boost his feelings of self-esteem. By contrast, a coach who derides or humiliates boys when they make mistakes, who pushes boys beyond their natural skill levels, or who offers words of encouragement only when the boys actually win, may cause our sons to feel ashamed, harden themselves in the ways we've already discussed, and hide behind a mask of false self-confidence. Likewise, a coach who teaches the value of balanced, disciplined effort, a personal best, rather than stressing fierce competition and winning as the crux of a game, can play a vital mentoring role that encourages boys to see sports as an opportunity for physical and emotional self-transformation, rather than as an outright test of his masculinity. "Mr. Hanks is a great coach," one 15-year-old reported about the coach of his high school football team. "Before we begin scrimmaging, he leads our team through an hour of calisthenics. We have to do about 100 sit-ups, push-ups, deep knee bends, jumping jacks, and a whole bunch of exercises. But Coach Hanks doesn't just shout out orders at us. He's yelling out what to do while he's doing it, too. He's real demanding, but he puts himself through the training with us." Another boy of the same age offered a similar sentiment about Mr. Hanks. He's great because he pushes you hard, but has a good attitude about it. Like he tells us that if we don't feel up to practice one day, we have to show up, but we can tell him we're tired, and for that day he'll give us a lighter, separate routine to do. Some coaches would just yell at you or push you harder. Mr. Hanks is realistic. He never tries to harass you or make you feel bad if you can't do something. He just seems to want to help us do the best we can.